There are parties behind and parties ahead, but these couple of days between December celebrations and January's New Year do afford a time to breathe, maybe a respite from all the holidazzle. The Roman poet Horace took the opportunity of a winter's day to slump on his couch, or whatever the Romans called couches, and ponder life and love. And, of course, he had his servant fetch some wine.
Good Thaliarchus, draw the wine we ask, that mellower vintage, 4-year-old, from out the cellared Sabine cask. The future leave to Jove.
Oh, my gosh, what a wonderful reading. That's Elaine Fantham, our commentator of all things classical here on Weekend Edition, who joins us from Toronto. Elaine, thanks very much. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Scott. You know, Horace could always find an excuse for wine, but he was always very precise about which wine it was. This time, he actually prepares you for wanting the wine by talking about the cold view of Mount Soracte covered in snow, the woods frozen, groaning with ice, and the rivers also frozen in their tracks. It's pretty persuasive stuff. And then he says, heap on some logs and draw the wine.
Now, we for the pendants among us, this is the ninth from Horace's first book of odes. Am I correct?
Quite right, yes, yes.
Now,
don't actually know, of course, once he got the wine, how he spent the evening. I have two theories. The more proper is that he spent the evening reading the Greek lyric poets that he so greatly loved. And the less proper is that he spent it reclining with Thaliarchus, because Horace didn't just like women.
I'm sorry. I catch your drift now. Right. Okay. I get that now. I'm interested in another bit of verse. What can you tell us about Trimalchio's feast?
Ah, well, now, I don't think you'd like Trimalchio's verse because it has about the quality of a Hallmark card. But certainly if you want a contrast from the quiet sobriety, as it were, of Horace, you want, I think, probably the most vulgar dinner party that's been described in Latin literature. And that is Trimalchio's feast. He was a self-made man. He has to play host to the narrator of the story, who is a slightly supercilious Ivy League type, who is nevertheless in need of a free meal. The meal is 9 courses, but I think there's only 2 that one would want to tell you about. And the first is a real Martha Stewart, eat your heart out kind of dish. It's a zodiac dish with 12 compartments, each one of which contains hors d'oeuvre food to match the zodiacal month. These look like very small helpings, and the guests are beginning to feel a bit cheated. It turns out that it has a false bottom, and underneath there are fish swimming in gravy being poured by silver mechanical satyrs at each of the 4 corners of the dish. But I really think that my favorite is the what follows, the wild boar. At this point, Trimalchio calls for the doors to be opened, and a pack of hounds come skeltering in, and the wild boar is carried into the middle of the table that's surrounded by the dining couches, and it has little baskets of dates hanging from either tusk. And it's supposed to be a female, a sow, and so it has little pastry piglets drinking, as it were, on either side. In comes not the standard carver that was used for dinners of this kind, but a huntsman with a huge great hunting knife, and he plunges it into the wild boar, and immediately a host of living thrushes break out of the hole that he's made. It's like the 4-and-20 blackbirds baked inside a pie we know from medieval pies.
One's inclined to say, boy, they knew how to throw a party. But this sounds, it wasn't a party to have a good time. There was an intensity to this, wasn't there?
Oh, everything was laid on in a very extravagant fashion. But actually, you know, I'd like to tell people that wild boar is rather good. And it's a great improvement on turkey.
May I ask, what about the wild thrushes? Have you ever been able to lay your tooth into one of them?
Well, I don't know. They certainly didn't try to serve the thrushes. They had fowlers to catch them, but they didn't try and serve them on the spot. But as you know, in Italy, they do all the time kill and serve the kind of birds we think should be protected.
Yeah. Elaine, why would Romans throw a party? Was it always a feast day? Could somebody just say we're going to cut back and have a good time? I want to thank somebody for
the fortune. Well, feast days, of course, were your best excuse. Mm-hmm. And indeed, there were, in the early Roman Republic, they tried to prevent people from having extravagant parties on non-feast days. They had what they called sumptuary laws, which were laws about expense, really. Mm-hmm. And essentially what this meant was that you could serve anything you liked if you'd grown it on your home farm or bought it in the local market. But if it was exotic imported fish or meats or one of those very, very extravagant dishes, then this was supposed to be against the law. Now, nobody's ever discovered how this law got monitored, and I think it was probably about as effective as prohibition.
Well, Elaine, you've certainly put us in the holiday mood. I'm just not sure which holiday at this particular point.
Yes, yes. Well, the Romans are coming up for a new year, but New Year tended to be a little bit less festive, so I think we probably make the most of the days we have before New Year.
Okay. Elaine, nice talking to you again. Take care.
Thank you, Scott. Goodbye and a happy new year.
And also to you. Elaine Fantham, who's Professor Emerita of Classics at Princeton University, speaking from the studios of the CBC in Toronto.